What the talk is titled is Antenna Alternatives. But alternatives to what? Okay, well, actually what it really is an alternative to the antenna. The antenna. Not just an alternative to having an antenna. The double CAS, the DCAS, has been addressed several times in talks, in conventions, as well as in a number of articles and presentations over the last few years, because it really is, it's a very directive antenna within a somewhat limited space. It has its variants and so forth, and there is a picture here. I'm sorry to the blind people, but it's a rough representation anyway, and besides, it's got a bird on it, which was a raptor of some sort that Bill Whitaker would have liked to have seen if he'd been there. Anyway, the antenna has become a bit of a gold standard because of its directivity within a limited space. But the limited space basically still involves 120 to 180 feet of linear space, and that is not what your average suburban backyard looks like. So we really need to look at some other, sort of ways of perhaps having an antenna that would be more suitable for somebody with limited space. And for the purpose of this talk, we'll only address those antennas that, say, deliver a signal with a cable to an antenna input on a radio, and will fit in that reasonable size city lot. Boosters for portable radio are another topic altogether, and we'll also not address phased antennas, which is another topic, because they retire, for broadband phasing, you require at least as much real estate as a DCAS, and likely more. So, as I said, what's the alternative? So let's analyze what one might need in an antenna. Now, the first thing is an ability to pick up signals. Okay, this is obvious, but actually, when you think of it, if you get into things like directional antennas, what you can get very easily sort of stuck on the idea that, wow, that's a 35 dB null. Great. What if you can't hear anything else? Because it might be a 35 dB null based on, a 35 dB loss as well. Go ahead. That's the ability to pick up signals. You really do have to consider that. Directionality. What do you want? Do you want a unidirectional antenna? They do exist, like the DCAS. Do you want a variable direction? Do you want to be able to sort of, swoop around in a null? Do you want a sharp null? Do you want a wide null? Or do you want no directionality at all, so you get a good idea of what the heck is going on all over the place? So it's going to be a bit of a, and then the other thing is the wide frequency coverage. The medium wave band covers a 3-to-1 frequency ratio. And you've got to be a little careful that some of these antennas are actually somewhat frequency limited, and you need to be aware of this. Okay, limitations to one's antenna choices. A small antenna footprint, amount of land. Most of us are limited in land. That's what we started with. Low cost. Can something be homebrewed easily? It's part of the charm of the hobby. You don't want to have to sort of say the only way you can get on, start listening is by hauling out your charge card and blowing a hole in it. Avoiding local noise problems. Are specific antennas better for handling local electrical noise? Strong local signals. If you have an antenna that has a preamplifier in it, you're going to have to worry about whether or not that preamplifier can handle those local signals that you have, as well as the DX you want to hear. Or will this be a stealth antenna? In which case, how easy is it to put up and take down? How visible is it? Okay, we have lots of receiving antennas from which to choose. And we're going to have to somehow organize this a bit. So we're going to do it in an arbitrary division of omnidirectional antennas, bidirectional antennas, unidirectional antennas. Okay, omnidirectional antennas, these receive from all directions. The advantage to them is they hear everything. The disadvantages, it hears everything. So you can't, you can't get rid of signals that you don't want to hear. These all tend to be electric field antennas, and I won't go into the complexities of the electromagnetic wave. I'll just throw that out. Now, they also tend to be vertical antennas or a variation thereof. The less vertical they are, the less omnidirectional. Vertical wires, so, and we have two sort of categories that I will address here. A vertical wire and transformer coupled, they may be amplified. You don't normally just take a chunk of wire and attach it to the antenna connector of your receiver. There will probably be a lot of grief, although that's the way things were done in the old days. Random wire is a variation of this. These tend to be somewhat less omnidirectional, depending on length and angle of elevation and so forth. But we do basically include them then. And then finally, there's the active whip antenna, which is not really a vertical antenna. We'll talk about that in a minute. Vertical antennas, and although I call them omnidirectional, not exactly. This is a 3D pattern from the book Low Band DXing, and it's sort of a, you see, it's sort of like a fat donut shape. In fact, response from straight up, you know, for really high angle response is actually fairly poor on a vertical antenna. But for the most part, our DX doesn't come up from there. But sometimes it does. And, one has to be aware of that. Okay, we'll move on next to vertical antennas, which are essentially transformer coupled to the receiver. And they use a ground rod. Dallas Langford defined the transformer-coupled vertical in an early article, though others have used the concept for many years, actually, to minimize noise pickup. It's essentially a wire, longer the better, and a ground rod matched to a feed line. The isolation is really important, and we'll address that in a second. Vertical antennas that are transformer-coupled to the feed line, as I mentioned, best, usually about 15 to 30 feet, in length. The advantage to it are small footprint, and they are sensitive. And if a sensitivity is an issue, if you want them more sensitive, they can be amplified, but you got to be careful. There's actually a lot of signal in there. They are resistant to feeder conducted electrical noise, they are if a separate ground is used, and this is really important. And as I mentioned, they are inexpensive, fairly easy to build, broadband. There are disadvantages to it. Better sensitivity requires more vertical height, and it starts to get difficult to get a support for it. And a higher quality ground is required. You definitely do need to have that ground to make the thing work well and to sort of keep the noise level down as well. The variations are, as I said before, random wire sloper, not quite as omnidirectional, but they can be quiet. There is, I'll just throw out an example of this. DX Engineering has something called a DXE ARAV3-1P. I don't have a picture of it with me. But, you can see it online.
It's in some of the catalogs back here.
Yeah, it's in some of the catalogs, and it's an unusual active, what people normally think of as an active antenna. It is amplified, but it needs a ground rod. So you actually have to mount that thing right close to the ground rod, and then you have an antenna that sticks up from it. And I'll go on to talk about active antennas. I think I've gotten hold of a couple of people who own the darn things, but they've never really got curious to find out what's inside it. So I'm still throwing that up in the air, but I think that that's what this actually is. It's an amplified transformer coupled vertical.
I got a screwdriver.
I don't have one that you can screwdrive. If we can find an owner, we'll look further at it. Okay. So now there's the active whip. And the active whip is a really small antenna that is, in fact, really useful. I'll tell you more about this photograph on the right. Again, apologies to our blind friends. But essentially, it's just a a whip antenna that's suspended up above the ocean at the Rockworks site in Oregon. It's usually quite a small antenna element, less than 4 feet long, plus an amplifier inside, you know, like a weatherproof box. It's actually not like that antenna I just described. It's really a capacitive probe in the electromagnetic field. It's a, you know, it's actually a plate of capacitor almost, and then you amplify the daylights out of what that, you know, the little, you know, sort of variations that appear on that either whip antenna or, you know, sort of, so it's such an insignificant portion of the wavelength that is the capacitor that's in there. In fact, the tiny PA0RDT mini whip, I put a picture right up in that upper right hand corner there, it's got a pen next to it. That thing is tiny. It has a, you know, like basically a plastic tube with an amplifier in it, and the amplifier has like a metal plate. It's not even a whip antenna, it's a metal plate. I've never used one. They're actually fairly inexpensive, about $37 from a Russian dealer. But they, you know, they have tons of signal output. The advantage is obviously small footprint, tiny footprint. They don't need a good ground connection for operation. They're just completely independent. They're broadbanded, really broadbanded. You know, some of them go up from basically, you know, below 100 kilohertz to well over 50 megahertz. They're sensitive. I was really surprised at hearing low-powered New Zealanders on the Oregon coast cliffs. It's not a panacea, but by gosh, you know, like, given the simplicity of it, it really, you know, sort of delivered. They can be homebrewed, but they are definitely, you need electronic skills, because it's essentially, it's dependent on the amplifier that's inside it. Disadvantages, yes. It requires placement away from nearby objects, preferably higher than everything around them. You know, like a roof peak of a house. Amplification inside, it doesn't matter how good that amplifier is. If you don't place that antenna well, you just don't hear signals. Not going to happen. You know, you just hear local noise, which, of course, is the other real bugbear that people who buy these things, and they usually do buy them rather than build them, they bung it up. And it's noisy. Gosh darn it. You know, like you hear all the local electrical noise. And the problem there is that it's basically a, you know, like a whip antenna, we'll say. And down below, you've got a coax cable that runs back to your receiver, or actually the interface unit that runs between the active antenna and your receiver. And all the noise that's conducted along that, you know, basically the coax cable itself is acting as an antenna. It's picking up all the local noise. It conveys it to that whip, amplifies the daylight out of it, sends it all the way back down the coax to your receiver. So you have to start to become really, really, really familiar with the common mode choke. And it's a bit of a technical issue. Once you make them work, you know, you get the thing choked off properly, they can actually be quite quiet. But by gosh, the initial, you know, sort of experience for a lot of people is that's just a noise picker-upper, and, you know, to hell with it. So, pardon me for that sort of brief break. And there is also a trade-off in the amplification that's inside there. This is a manufacturer's problem, but if you build it yourself, it's going to be your problem. Between sensitivity and strong signal handling. Yeah, you can put a, like, if you have a 4-foot whip, you can get more signal if you put an 8-foot whip on that damn thing. There's only a small problem with that. 8-foot whip delivers enough signal that starts to overload the amplifiers. Then you get all sorts of intermodulation products. So you haven't solved any of your problems. So you have to have a good amplifier in there. And that means that some of them can be really, really costly. I mean, these are sold as professional antennas. You can spend like $500 for a whip antenna. I told you about the mini whip. For $37, it's an absolute steal. But you need to know what you're doing with the coax chokes and so forth. Bidirectional antennas, and incidentally, if there are questions, you know, raise a hand during this. You know, like, you can even ask about making more noise. For the home user, these are likely to be loop antennas. They respond primarily to the magnetic component of the electromagnetic wave. Again, I will not go into details of that. It's just a a fact I will throw out. A well-balanced loop can, in fact, be used for nulling interfering stations, but also for direction finding, sometimes quite easily, you know, and very accurately. The tuned loop antenna is one version of a bidirectional antenna, and I've just thrown up a schematic diagram there, and you can see it's essentially a resonant circuit of an inductor and capacitor with a feed line going back to the receiver. Broadband loop antenna is even simpler. It's just a big loop of wire. And what we got here is it's usually a single turn, maybe area of tens of square feet. And the inductive signal takeoff, which is indicated in both these schematic diagrams, can in fact be replaced by an antenna, not an amplifier, that matches the impedance of it's a high impedance of the tuned loop antenna, low impedance of the broadband loop antenna. So you have to know what you're doing. Very often you are buying that from a manufacturer. Tuned loop antennas, generally what we consider two different kinds. There's a ferrite core, which is quite small, and an air core, which is, on the area, usually about 2 to 3 feet on a side, multiple turns of wire resonated with a tuning capacitor. Advantages of the tuned loop antenna: small footprint, particularly ferrite. Jerry Thomas's quantum loop, which is still available, is really a wonderful little antenna for quite a reasonable price, and it'll fit in your house. But we will talk about the disadvantage that comes from that. Under ideal low noise circumstances, it can be used indoors. It has surprisingly good sensitivity, considering its size. An unamplified air core loop that I had years ago, I was hearing Australia, East Asia, and Europe in days past from Victoria, British Columbia. That's it. I had a reasonable receiver, but no better than any people here have. And it was just remarkably productive. You can rotate to find the direction of signal or null out interference. Home construction, particularly of air core loops, is really possible. There's still a lot of club plans that are available. Ferrite requires more electronic construction skills because you can't really do an unamplified version. They have to have an amplifier in them. But it is possible. Now, disadvantage: single frequency tuning. These things are resonant, so you're going to listen to one frequency at a time with this. In the age of software-defined radios, that is a huge disadvantage for a lot of people. Because it's indoors, to allow that easy tuning and the rotating control and so forth, it's sensitive to the noise that we have in our houses. Yes, fire away, Skip.
There's a third bullet too, Nick. I learned when I moved to Arizona 20 years ago, where all the homes are stuck.
Yes.
Where you've got chicken wire. It creates a giant Faraday cage, and no loop is going to work.
However beautiful it used to be in your old house, yes. That is an excellent point. Fortunately, it's something I've never experienced, but I've heard about it. And yet again, something you've got to be aware of. It's one of my sort of retirement projects. I really want to remote my old loop and, basically get it out of the noise field of my house and see if I can, get relive the good old days of actually hearing Australia again on the darn things. Okay. So, there are also broadband loop antennas. And I have a picture here, a couple of pictures actually. One is of basically it's like a hula hoop. This one is provided by Wellbrook in Great Britain. The small bird on it is optional, but they are bird purchased. And if you look carefully at the sort of rural looking picture on the right, you will see that there is a triangle shaped loop of white wire. It's about 100 feet of wire, maybe about 18 feet high at the apex. And this is what you call a really easy antenna to set up. So the smaller varieties on the left are easily rotatable, so they can be used for direction finding, but they require greater amplification. Larger ones can be easy to construct, as I mentioned, in Delta format. I'll just throw in that these small loops that are amplified, you can buy them commercially, probably the best way to do it, but you can also, homebrew version by Everett Sharp was recently in the IRC technical column, so it is possible to make them yourself. They are fairly expensive. The ALA 1530 is around 250 to 300 pounds. Mind you, the value of the pound has dropped quite a lot since Brexit, so it's worth looking into. The Pixel Loop is now from DX Engineering. That's $500 out of the starting gate.
I don't know if you talked about passive antennas while I was gone, but I brought an example with me.
Exactly. I was going to mention that. I saw that baby yesterday because that's... I've just gone past that, but that is a commercial version of a passive-tuned air core loop, and a couple of manufacturers make it. That one is Grundig AN200, and it's a cute little thing. It's the sort of thing nobody would be, sort of ashamed to have in their living room coffee table. And they're quite inexpensive. I think Universal Radio's got one on sale right now for $20.
Really?
Yeah.
Give it to Terry so she can put her hands on it.
Okay, sure.
Not much there, but it does a heck of a job.
Yeah. And that that could be either used to boost a portable radio, or you can actually connect it to the antenna input of a more sophisticated receiver. But it's a single frequency, you tune it. Thanks for bringing that by the way, Rick. I saw that last night, and I thought I got to include that in the talk, and promptly forgot. Broadband loop advantages: wide band response. Again, this is like the active whip, and in fact, it's a competitor to it. Like that 100, less than 100 kilohertz to over 30 megahertz. Inexpensive home construction really is possible. The Delta configuration uses just one support post. Though a preamplifier might drive up the cost, but it's a worthwhile investment, I found. They can be mounted with the lower portions, like really close to the ground. I mean, the active whip antenna, you got to get that baby up, and it's got to be high. This thing, you can just throw it, you shouldn't have it lying on the ground, although you can get away with that, but just even a couple of feet above the ground for the lowest portions of it, and it'll sing for you. There just don't seem to be negative consequences. You can actually literally drape it over foliage. Just throw it up in a bush or something like that. So it makes a great stealth antenna. They can be positioned to null interference, not ones that you throw over a bush, but you could choose even that. You could sort of try and figure out where your interference is coming from, but it's a little more difficult. They can be placed indoors, but preferably outdoors. Because that way they're away from the noise sources. They're relatively insensitive to local noise conveyed along the feed line. And this is where, if you want an active antenna, this is probably the way to go, because it really makes life a lot simpler, both the issue of being able to mount it fairly close to the ground and get good signals out of it, and the fact that they do tend to be resistant to the noise that's conveyed along a feed line or picked up along a feed line. And the ALA 100, which is also from Wellbrook, is an amplifier that can be used with the broadband loop, just that chunk of wire that you throw up on in a bush or something like that. And it's been very popular just because it's so darn easy to use, as I mentioned, low to the ground, low noise. It does have disadvantages. As I mentioned, I do mention preamplifiers several times. If you just use a bare wire, it's basically a low signal output antenna. And you need to be aware, this may be a disadvantage, but you need to be aware that it does have nulls. You don't want to place it in such a way that it's going to actually not hear your DX. So, We're moving on to our next topic, our next division of antennas, and this is unidirectional antennas. And strangely enough, you have choices. A unidirectional antenna is not just one direction. You could have just, you know, like a searchlight. You could have just a narrow lobe in one direction. Null everything else. That ultimate antenna is a spotlight. Practically, this is difficult, requiring phased antennas and plenty of room at medium wave frequencies, so we're probably not going to address it too much more in this talk. Okay, here's a second choice, a broad front lobe and a broad rear null. This is actually, because DX conditions are unpredictable, that spotlight that I talked about, you can miss DX. You know, especially if it's an antenna that you can't move, you know, like that spotlight around. So to have a broad sort of field of view is really useful in those situations. And the other thing is that if you have a location like we do on the coast where there are, you know, basically everything is DX off the front end, right? You want to hear everything that's out there and let conditions determine what's coming in today. The final choice in unidirectional antennas is a sharp null in one direction and a broad lobe in another direction. And this is useful if you have interference that you really want to get rid of and you want to hear everything else that's in the opposite direction from the interference. Now, at least one of the above criteria can be provided by a family of unidirectional antennas called the non-resonant terminated loop, to make a mouthful out of it. And we'll discuss that now. There are several of these variants. One is called the U, one is called the K9AY flag, one is called the CAS, which is a variant of the terminated delta, it's a squashed delta, and the Conti super loop. And again, you can see that these all have, from the diagram there of the response, the antenna response, you can see that they all tend to have a sharp null in them, a fairly broad null, but you know it's there's still signal that you can pick up off the back end, and then a nice front lobe. These are mostly refinements of Earl Cunningham's pennant antenna, derived, which I think was in 1998, and Floyd Kuntz had described a U antenna earlier in 1995 in QST, I believe, which was really the grandfather of all these kinds of antennas, but they really are a recent development, or are they? In fact, actually, Harold Beveridge had a patent for something like the flag in 1941, but even Harold wasn't there first. Roland Keane in Britain, I believe, in 1927 edition of Wireless Direction Finding described something like the K9AY. These guys were really good. The theorists in those days were fabulous, very inventive. So there's nothing new under the sun. So non-resonant terminated loops, let's have some advantages to these guys. They are, in fact, fit in a city lot, though they can be somewhat larger. They're terminated with approximately a kilo-ohm of resistance opposite the signal takeoff point. And we'll show some diagrams in a minute so that you'll understand this better. The termination faces towards the direction of the null. The termination can be variable and remotely controllable, which deepens the null. And that can be a number of things, and possibly this will be discussed a little later, but we have, you could actually just have a potentiometer out there. That means you have to go run out and adjust the pot. But it can be remotely controllable for added flexibility in the nulling. The Vactrol terminations exist. Mark Connolly, suggested this years ago with the flag antenna and had a very clever remote system that used the feed line to actually adjust the termination value of the Vactrol as well. And Bruce Conti has recently developed a remotely controllable pot, using a little motor. That is a genius idea also. The signal takeoff is via a transformer or a preamplifier, and all can be preamplified. For weak signal, Coastal DX probably should be preamplified, and the Welbert Flag 100, FLG 100, seems to be chosen by many, sort of an out-of-the-box solution. The first one is, like the granddaddy of them all, is the U, which is essentially a U-shaped wire. It's about 15 feet vertical, 38 feet horizontal. One end, again, the direction where the signal's coming from is where the termination, or the signal is being nulled, is the termination resistor, around, in his case, 820 ohms. And then there's a matching transformer off the other side, which 9-to-1, 16-to-1, again, or a preamplifier, the 1K input. Dimensions are not too critical. The ratio is a bit more. A larger U delivers more signal. The advantages: strongest signal output for odd size of all the unidirectional antennas. Simple construction for the home brewer. The large signal output is due to the grounded vertical elements. Essentially, you're doubling. It tends to have 6 dB more signal output. Disadvantages: requires two vertical supports, not all do, and two ground rods, and you have to have good ground. The better the available ground, the better the signal strength, and the better the antenna can null. And people have been sort of knocked sideways by putting up a U and saying this darn thing doesn't work very well, because the ground is lousy. The next one is the K9AY, which is more a sort of a delta shape, and it is in this illustration here, the termination resistor and the matching transformer are actually both at the base where the ground rod is, and they're in a box there. But they have the same arrangement of one end has a termination resistor, the other end has a transformer or an amplifier in this case.
Do you need a ground with this one?
Yes, K9AY, that's another one, but people have been knocked sideways. They put up John Bryant had a beautiful description of that, because he started his K9AY in his Oklahoma cow pasture. And he said, brilliant antenna, it's the last thing any DXer needs. And then he took it to Grayland in the summertime. And he said, lousy antenna, why did I waste my time? Because Grayland in the summer is just like a desert. It's all dried out. And no amount of ground rod is going to give you a good ground. So it's sort of like a U folded in on itself on the bottom, but it still needs the ground. That is our advantages: single to vertical support, really small footprint. I think for a medium wave, you can put it in 30 feet. It can be homebrewed. There are circuit boards available for amplifiers and matchers and so forth from Far Circuits, or Array Solutions has a total solution. I don't remember whether you still provide the wire and post. I think they have a total solution. Disadvantages: needs a good ground or multiple radials, and you just can't forget that, because otherwise you wonder why you wasted your time. It likely needs a preamplifier for medium wave. It is a small amplifier, a small antenna, small signal output. The array is fairly, I'll get to you in a sec, the array is fairly complex if home built, but you can actually, as I should have mentioned before, an array is commercially available. You can use more of these and actually do null steering and so forth, and they're a clever device, commercially clever device. Yes?
What type of wire do you recommend for durability?
Stranded, for starters. Stranded, insulated. Depending on whether you have ice is I think, the big determinant. I have gotten away with using number 20, number 22 for, on my flags at home, and we have high winds there, but then the stress is taken by, pulleyed off. It becomes a matter of construction. So, but as long as the wire can flop around in the wind somewhat and the stresses are taken by the ends, you can get away with, but if I had ice, freezing rain, for example, all bets are off, in which case you probably need something more like number 16, insulated again and stranded. Any other recommendations from the audience on that?
I use number 14. You can buy the stuff at Home Depot.
Yes. Yeah.
That's what I tend to use, and it's very, very hard to break.
Yes, and you live in an environment where things do tend to break.
In Illinois,
yeah.
And,
Yep.
Yeah, we get our share of ice.
Okay, I think I finished with the K9AY. Here's the flag. This is a rather complicated diagram from Mark Connolly, and I'm thinking probably I should have cleaned it up. But essentially, it too is it's more a balanced looking antenna. You know, the takeoff and termination are in the center of the antenna. It can be closer to the ground than the 23 feet that's indicated here, which is the height of the lower element of it. Though I believe they pick up a bit more noise when they're somewhat lower down. The ratio of the horizontal to the vertical is more important than the actual size of the thing, so you can expand these. Advantages: better signal output compared with a delta, with the same linear footprint. It's fairly easily homebrewed, and no grounding is required. The impression that I have is one that's elevated and unamplified was a somewhat quieter antenna. The nulls seem to be much the same, though. Disadvantages: two vertical supports. If freestanding, you need to guy these buggers, because otherwise it's just going to try and fold in on itself. The termination and output feed line are halfway up the elements. You want to adjust the termination, you either have to remotely termination, or you'll be running out there with quite a long step ladder. And it does add to the complexity of the assembly. So then let's move on to the popularly known CAS.
Nick?
Yes?
What's the difference between Mark's flag and a superloop?
The termination and the upwind, I have the superloop a little later.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Yeah. But basically, the superloop takes down the termination and the output down to the ground.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a U with a ground connection between it. Diagram here. The original CAS was only 10 feet by 40 feet, but again, like it's a squash delta. Termination on one side, feed point on the other side. That's what the TB and the FB stand for, termination box and feed box. The height above ground is not wildly important. So, easy to put up. It's a convenient antenna, and I'll discuss a little further some details about it in the next slide. Advantages, obviously, single vertical support again, and no grounding is required. Although the 10 by 40 is actually fairly insensitive, it's very easily scalable. You can make this quite a bit bigger as long as you keep the dimensions, the ratio of the dimensions correct. It's easily homebrewed, easily assembled and taken down. I have found it to be a tremendous antenna. So go off and visit friends out in the country somewhere, and I can throw this out in a field somewhere, and it's done in 20 minutes, and it's less than that to take it down. And gives you a lot of fun if you're in a good location. Disadvantage: slightly slower signal output for the same footprint compared with the flag or you. It's literally that 6 dB, in one comparison, due to that lack of ground with the U. And just basically it's the dimension. You effectively have less vertical height on a delta than you do with a flag.
Mark, is the one in the setup out back here, does that have roughly the same dimensions as the one we had in Minneapolis 3 years ago, or is it smaller or larger?
I don't know. Was it? Did you have 140?
No, what we had set up in Minneapolis, I believe, was only a single.
It's a single CAS. It wasn't a double CAS we have out here.
What we have set up out here is a double CAS.
Yeah. This is the competition. Essentially, this is what I'm comparing everything to, is what we have out here. Okay, the next one here is the Conti Superloop, which Mark was asking about a moment ago. And as you can see, it looks like a flag antenna. It's just that the termination and the output have been basically, sort of taken. Oh, yes. All right. Now I have to learn how to use this.
Push the red button.
There we go. Okay. Termination resistor and the signal takeoff are now down at ground level, making for a lot easier adjustment. And this was, you know, if you look at it, you can also, if you think back to the U antenna that I showed you earlier, essentially it's just a U antenna that instead of having ground at each end, has a connection between each end at the bottom. And it can literally lie on the ground, the bottom. Bruce Conti describes this quite well on his website. It can go up to 30 feet vertical, 100 feet horizontal. I have found that the null is not quite as deep as the flag, but it seems to be somewhat wider, you know, with the ones that I have used versus a flag. It's a nice, nice antenna. Advantages, not ground dependent like the U is. Easily scaled up and down, easily homebrewed, fairly easily assembled and taken down, and the signal output is higher than a delta with the same linear footprint. Disadvantages, slightly lower output signal for the same footprint compared with the U, but the advantages, you know, like to me, it's a disadvantage. It's an easy price to pay because grounds are terrible to sort of say it's going to be, you know, good continuously. The two vertical supports are required, like the flag. You've got to guy them, and that's why it's not quite so easy to regard it as a temporary antenna. Okay, so here we come to the big question, because the DCAS is a unidirectional antenna, and these are unidirectional antennas I've been describing. So is a non-resident terminated loop an alternative to a DCAS at all? All the non-resonant terminated loops described here give much the same depth of nulls to stations off the back end of the antenna, range of 10 to 25 dB, sometimes even deeper, depending on the termination resistance and depending on how far off, directly off the back of the antenna they are, you know, sort of off the axis of the antenna. The signal strengths off the front end of these loops are within a couple of dB of what a DCAS can deliver. So, you know, you say, well, hold on. How good are they compared to the DCAS? And I throw up a diagram here, and these are to scale. And so I'm comparing on the diagram a DCAS, that sort of double set of triangles at the top, to a standard flag down at the bottom. So you can see that it's a lot larger antenna. It's the gold standard DX antenna. But by gosh, that little flag, you know, it's, you know, the most productive DCASs on the coast take up a minimum of 120 feet compared with the 30 to 50 feet of the non-terminated loops. This is hardly a fair comparison, you would think, and yet on paper it doesn't look that bad. A standard flag antenna was compared, actually, with a 160-foot long DCAS in Grayland, Washington, both of them aimed at 270 degrees. The DCAS signal is going to be heard first in the following net SDR playback, followed by the flags. Listen to, and unfortunately with the audio here, you may not hear the difference, but you can see the difference because I have an SDR display with there as well. Here we go. 4RN 792. It looks like a stop in the room, actually. Anyway, let's see if I can do it. Pardon me? This one, the first one is the DCAS. Yeah, and you can see 792 signal is up there at pretty much the center. Okay, stop. So you can see halfway along that display going up from the bottom is the DCAS, and then the flag is switched in. And, you know, like you can't really see much change in the 792's strength, but the background noise has increased. So what we really should care most about is the carrier-to-noise ratio. You know, because as we saw there, the noise level comes up, but the raw signal didn't seem to change. So what we're really looking at is the strength of that carrier on 792, again, the SDR display, versus the noise, which is down in this case nearer 793. And if the signal strength that we saw on the display is averaged for 25 seconds either side of that changeover point from the DCAS to the flag for both the carrier and the noise in the recorded file, The following relationships are found. The carrier on the flag is minus 92 dBm. The DCAS average signal strength was minus 94.5. So there's actually an increase in signal level, a small increase in signal level on the flag. The noise, however, on the flag is minus 132.1 dBm. The DCAS average was minus 139.2 dBm. Considerable difference in the background level of interference. So the carrier noise ratio on the flag is 40.1 dB, the DCAS 44.7. So we're talking about like a 4.6 difference dB in that carrier to noise ratio. And it's the carrier to noise that determines whether you hear the thing or not. And this is admittedly just for 4RN. There are wheels within wheels on this one, but it's an interesting observation, shall we say. Incidentally, on that one, the carrier and the noise signals are both averaged in a 0.7 hertz bandwidth. You know, so we're really sort of zeroing in there on both of those. We should be getting exactly what we're looking at. We also, I did average 3 seconds on either side, and it really wasn't that much difference. So we're not looking at a signal that's fading up or down throughout that period. The explanation for the difference in the flag raw signal levels, the DCAS actually loses sensitivity somewhat at the low end of the band, and this is a problem of in the actual design, and nobody's been able to quite find a way around it.
Go bigger.
Go bigger, but then you start to lose your directivity at the high end.
Right.
If we look at an example, horizontal patterns generated by EasyNeck antenna modeling software, we can see subtle differences in the response off the back end of both of these antennas. On the left is the flag, and that has that classic, like, sharp front-back to ratio, front-to-back ratio, nice sharp null, but a null right off the back of the axis. And it gets a little more bulbous in its response from that back 180 degrees. So you are going to hear more interference off the back. If you look at the DCAS one, it's actually a less, you know, the whole signal in response is smaller, but it really nulls a lot of the stuff, you know, pretty much everything off the back end. It doesn't have that sharp a null, but it has a really wide null off the back. So, it really, is there a way to quantify this relationship between these two antennas? And the answer to that is, yeah, they've been doing this in the radio amateur world using something called receiving directivity factor, RDF. It's often used as such a measure. It's an arbitrary number that can be defined as the ratio in the average signal level, sorry about this, delivered by the antenna over plus or minus 10 degrees from the point of maximum response, you know, so both in the altitude and azimuth, compared with the average signal delivered by that antenna for every direction. And the display here has been snaffled from a talk by Carlos Da Silva, N4IS, gave a webinar earlier on this year, I believe, and it shows that earlier vertical response that we saw, and superimposed on that is a response from a highly